Alrighty, so we'll try this again, take two. It is Tuesday evening, January 25th, 2011. It's been several weeks since we last looked at Rabbi Akiva, thanks to a couple of snowouts and the Beit Midrash session that we had a couple of weeks ago. We'll have another one next week. Not sure what the topic is yet, but in the meantime, today we're concluding Rabbi Akiva. We split Rabbi Akiva up into four parts because there was just so much information about him. It didn't really seem fair to cram it all in. You could say it might not be fair about any of the Tanaim and Amoraim. You could probably spend a full, you know, semester on each one if you go through all the history, go through things that they say, try to put together a whole mindset. But with Rabbi Akiva, there's enough just in the history alone without even getting too much into halacha. Today, we're going to discuss a bit of the death of Rabbi Akiva, not just, you know, the death, which is a one-shot story, but also a few of the events leading up to it, in particular his time in prison. The sources that we're using are, I believe, entirely from either the Mishnah or the Babylonian Talmud. You'll find sometimes some later legends about Rabbi Akiva. And we've been discussing throughout this entire series the difficulties of using the Gemara for history and whether or not you can take these as historically accurate or whether or not they represent a tradition about Rabbi Akiva, but they may not be 100% in line with history. Huge academic debate about this. However, the further you go chronologically and geographically from a person, the greater the likelihood you'll find embellishments. Right, so, you know, I try to, like, if you get to, like, medieval Midrashim and, you know, they have stories about Rabbi Akiva, I think there's less of a likelihood to take this as, you know, this is, you know, something particularly about him. Not to say that, you know, the stuff here actually happened, but I think there's less of a likelihood for over-embellishments. And I think it also will help show a little bit better what was the tradition of Rabbi Akiva. Because I don't think when you get to later generations, people are going to be as nuanced about it. Where Rabbi Akiva is just this great rabbi, you can insert him in various places. Dr. Ellman gave that example once with Rav Yochanan, whom we'll get to in a couple of weeks, where sometimes the Babylonian Talmud, the Bavli, will use Rabbi Yochanan just because Rabbi Yochanan lived in Israel and they were citing a source from Israel. So the Yerushalmi could have it in a different name. Rav the Bavli, they knew it was from Eretz Yisrael. They weren't quite sure who. So they said, it's Rav Yochanan. And it's sort of like this catch-all. Got plenty of evidence for that, but that involves comparing Yerushalmis. Stuff that we just have not even a little bit of time to discuss. But yeah.
Would you say that if one was to remove the poetry, that the description we read on Yom Kippur is somewhere near accurate?
Hard to tell. I mean, it's accurate in which sense? In terms of historically accurate, none of us were there. Or at least I can tell you I wasn't. You know, it's
Consistent with the Mishnah?
I wouldn't necessarily say Mishnah. It's consistent with, partially consistent with one source, not necessarily another. You could say one source can leave out information, another one leaves it in. And forgive me for not saying this at the beginning, but spoiler alert, Rabbi Akiva does in fact die.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, everyone else does, but Rabbi Akiva...
How is it a spoiler alert?
Well, because I'm letting you know at the very beginning.
It's also part of the Yom Kippur service.
Right, well, exactly. That's what Dana was asking. And, you know, part of the question is, you know, the Yom Kippur service of El Ezkara is, you know, poetic. When you have poetry, you're going to embellish, and you're going to find the most descriptive, the most graphic descriptions of an event, because it makes for better poetry. It's a lot more evocative. It's a lot more emotional. So you're going to go for as much as you can there. So, you know, that's, you know, their side, and that's also what, you know, part of the point of PUTMAR. But here again, we're just going to focus on Gemaras. All right, and specifically the Bavli, Yerushalmi has a couple of differences, but, you know, I figure this will keep it up for now. So the first couple of sources deal with Rabbi Akiva in jail. Dana, start us off.
Okay. Can I try the Hebrew?
Sure. This is, one second, it's Yevamot 108b, Kofchan Amid Bet.
I'm guessing it's Sachru, Adam Echad, Barba Meizuz, Yeshalus Rabbi Akiva, Bebes Hasur, and Ba'asa. Tired demand for 400 Zuz. And through him, they addressed the inquiry to Rabbi Akiva in prison, and he stated that she was forbidden.
Yeah, we're in the...
Who's she?
We're in the middle of a halachic discussion here that I didn't want to, you know, get into the full details. Point of this small little snippet is that when Rabbi Akiva was in jail, despite being in jail, ostensibly people had limited access to him, the sages would actually pay the guy, which at this time was the equivalent of, say, 400 zuz is like 2 years' salary in their days. 400 zuz to act as a messenger to get a question to him.
One question?
Yeah. Well, they only had, I mean, we don't know if, like, there was a list, but, you know, that they had. One would think there might have been a lot, but this was actually a Gittin case. So if it was a Gittin case, they might have said, you know what, this is important enough, you know, send her out. So send him out. Yeah. Stephen, please take source number two, Psachim 112a.
Okay. Five things did Rabbi Akiva charge Rabbi Simon ben Yochai when he was immured in prison. He, the latter, said to him, "Master, teach me Torah." "I will not teach you," he replied. "If thou wilt not teach me," said he, "I will tell my father Yochai, and he will deliver thee to the state." "My son," answered he, "more than the calf wishes to suck does the cow desire to suckle." Said he to him, "Yet who is in danger? Surely the calf is in danger." Said he to him, "If you wish to be strangled, to be hanged on a tree..."
Large tree.
Right, so be hanged on a large tree, and when you teach your son, teach him from a corrected scroll. Do you want to beat the rest?
Well, I'll explain, you know, in a second here. So, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai visited Rabbi Akiva when Rabbi Akiva was in jail. So it's beyond just even asking a simple halachic question. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai still wanted to learn with him. And Rabbi Akiva's response was, like, "What do you, you know, I can't teach, I'm in jail, what do you mean, I'm just not going to do it." And then he says, "You know, if you don't teach me Torah, my father's just going to send me away." Right, Aniel Marley Yochai, I'm going
to
tell...
Oh, wait, he'll send, "Deliver thee to this thing."
Oh, sorry, you're right. Umasar Echala Malch, well... right. Thank you. He'll give you over to the government. So
yeah.
And this is, you know, when he's already in prison, right? So it's not like things are looking up for him, right? So even so, like, he's effectively blackmailing him, which isn't a great thing. And Rabbi Akiva, you know, gives a very interesting mashal here. He's saying, you know, "You tear me masha ego rotze leinak para yotze leinik." Right? You know, you want to, like, I want to, you know, teach it as, you know, badly as, you know, because you want to spread the Torah.
Yeah.
And the response was, well, who's the one who's really at risk here, right? Because it's the calf, who, if the calf doesn't drink, you know, calf doesn't get nourishment, the calf is going to die. So then Rabbi Akiva basically says, you know, what can I do? You're kind of right here. That if you want to be strangled, im bakashta lechanak, I'd love Ilan Gadol there. If you're going to hang, at least hang from a long, you know, a tall tree. Just, you know, if you're going to go out in a blaze of glory. If you're going to do it right. In context, if you're going to, you know, put yourself, you know, at risk for learning Torah, at least do it with someone who's worth it. And the other mashal about, you know, teaching from a corrected scroll is, you don't want to teach someone initially the wrong thing. You want to teach it to, because you teach from a corrected scroll, according to the opinion of Rava or Rav Masharshia, a new scroll that hasn't been erased because you can still see markings, right? If you teach someone incorrectly at the very beginning, it's much harder to reteach. Whereas if you teach them right the first time, they don't have to go back and relearn it. Anyone who, say, you know, teaches an instrument knows that, you know, if you learn it the wrong way, it's really hard to unlearn bad habits.
Is this the famous Simeon ben Yochanai that we celebrate on Lag BaOmer?
Well, same Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Yeah.
Why didn't we have the Aleph?
Where?
In Yochai.
It's spelt differently, different places.
Okay.
Or grammatical variants, things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get to Rav Shimon bar Yochai. He'll get his own class, maybe a couple here. So we have another, we've got a Mishnah in Yevamot, where sister-in-law performed chalitz in the presence of two or three men. One of them was discovered to be a relative or one in any other way, unfit to act as a judge. Her chalitz is invalid. Rav Shimon and Rav Yochanan HaSandler declared it valid. Furthermore, it once happened that a man submitted to chalitza privately between himself and herself in a prison, and where the case came before Rabbi Akiva, he declared considered the chalitza valid.
Chalitza is a shoe, right?
Yeah. Right.
It's pretty funny that Rav Yochanan and the Sandler had something to say about it.
Right. So there are opinions. This is a mission in Yevamot 12.5. Some people actually ascribe this to be a case where Rabbi Akiva himself was in prison at the same time, too, even though it's not as straight explicit in the Mishnah. But there was an opinion, and so that's why I figured to throw it in. You learn an extra Mishnah. That was Yevamot 12.5. Now we get one more here. Dana?
Okay. Masav Rabbi Akiva, Shehaya Kavush, Kadesh HaSurim?
Yeah.
I want to punctuate it right. The Iber.
Yeah.
Shalosh Shanim Zu Achar Zu. Iber
would probably be more correct, even though there's the Iber. Yeah. So, do you know what the word means?
Well, something like the PL of Avar past.
Yeah. No, it's from the root that means
intercalated.
Intercalated. Yeah, that's the Cincino for you. Ibor HaChodesh means it's a pregnant month, otherwise known as a leap year.
Oh.
So this is the verbal form of to make the year pregnant, i.e., you rule that this year is a leap year.
So three of them in a row.
Yeah.
Number low, Mishaya.
Misham, right? From that's a is you know that's a proof in there.
Based in Yashu, Vikivu, or Vikavu, Achas, Bisman.
Okay. Yeah.
So Rav Shimon said, is that really?
No, Rav Shimon part I cut out from the Hebrew.
Okay.
But there was a happening with Rabbi Akiva.
Once happened that Rabbi Akiva, when kept in prison, intercalated 3 years in succession. Rabbis, however, retorted, is that your proof? Okay, fine. The court sat and intercalated each year at its proper time. Is that your proof of what?
Again, a larger discussion about Ibor HaChodesh, about the rules of leap year. So according to this Gemara in Sanhedrin 12a, there's a dispute. According to Rav Shimon, Rabbi Akiva would actually calculate the months when he was in jail.
Cool.
And, well, yes, except everyone else said that actually didn't quite happen. Rather, the court did it every time. Which shows that even in the time of the Gemara, the historical transmissions can have a bit of a, whatchamacallit, they're not entirely accurate.
Well, assuming he can't see the moon, then he's going to have trouble with this.
Well, doesn't a base then have to pronounce a leap year anyway?
Well,
they have to declare the leap year anyway.
So the implication of what Rav Shimon can say is like, wow, Rabbi Akiva, smart enough to do it on his own, and response of the sages is, no, not how it works.
Right.
But you at least had a hava mina, you had a theoretical idea out there that said, here's how it works. And the rabbi said, nice try, not quite accurate. But it kind of helps show the esteem in which Rabbi Akiva was held, if nothing else. Stephen, take source number 5, Gemara in Erevin 21b.
Okay. Our rabbis taught Rabbi Akiva was once confined in a prison house, and Rav Joshua, the grits maker,
was attending to him. So Rav Yeshua HaGrisi. this is how they translate it. I'm just going with the Cincino one here.
Greasy grits, huh?
No, that's what it says.
Every day a certain quantity of water was brought into him. On one occasion, he was met by the prison keeper who said to him, your water today is rather much. Do you perhaps require it for undermining the prison? He poured out half of it and handed him the other half. When he came to Rabbi Akiva, the latter said to him, Joshua, do you not know that I am an old man and my life depends on yours? When the latter told him all that had happened, Rabbi Akiva said to him, give me some water to wash my hands. It will not suffice for drinking, the other complained. Will it suffice for washing your hands? What can I do, the former replied. When for neglecting the words of the rabbis, one deserves death? It is better that I myself should die than that I should transgress against the opinion of my colleagues. It was related that he tasted nothing until the other had brought him water wherewith to wash his hands. When the sages heard of this incident, they remarked, if he was so scrupulous in his old age, how much more must he have been so in his youth? If he so behaved in a prison house, how much more must he have behaved in such a manner when not in a prison house?
Right. If you follow that, long story short here, he's in jail. They give him a finite amount of water, and he would rather wash his hands, for eating than use it for drinking. And the logic here is, well, because, if by transgressing the words of the rabbis of Chazal, right, chayvim aleihem mitah, and, we have some evidence about that, particularly with Rav Tarfon, whom we'll see in another week, violating commandments being worthy of, rabbinic commandments being worthy of death. And the response of the rabbis here is like, wow, if this is how firm he is in prison, imagine how firm he would have been outside. Now, letter of the law halacha, you could, somewhat justify and say that, well, if your life is in danger, certainly pikuach nefesh, saving your life, should, take precedence over rabbinic law. Whether or not, again, this happened historically, I don't know, versus they're trying to make a point about the righteousness of Rabbi Akiva, which is kind of how it ends. God willing, none of us in this room or listening will ever be imprisoned and faced with such a quandary. Halacha l'maasa, I would probably suggest you drink rather than wash. That's just my own, it's really your life or washing, I would not suggest doing this halacha l'maasa. But it does help show, again, part of the tradition of Rabbi Akiva and where he fits into, just in how much esteem, and we saw that in some of our previous lectures about him. You're really considered superlative even amongst his colleagues, whether or not this is, encouraged for halachic purposes.
How lame a prison does this have to be that water could undermine the prison?
It's an interesting question because despite it being a prison, and we also have, there are a few stories we have about Tanaim Tanaim at least in prison, and a lot of dialogue that goes on there, which kind of indicates security might not have been the best, or at least in terms of getting visitors. And in fact, we saw one a couple of weeks ago about two people in prison, and a discussion between them came out. How did that get out? So when you have things like that, it's kind of, there's room to be skeptical about whether or not a dialogue in prison between two people actually happened, because, it's a prison. And, unless they're like hanging outside, trying to get the information. Gemara Psachim 69a has a very interesting statement which sort of makes sense in retrospect. There's a debate with Rabbi Akiva. So Tanya Amar Lo Reb Eliezer Akiva v'shchita hishavtani v'shchita tehemitato. You have refuted me by shchita, and by shchita will be your death, or will be his death. Shchita referring to the ritual slaughter of animals. In the context of the Gemara, Rabbi Akiva gave an answer to question having nothing to do with shchita, and he gave an analogy to shchita. So almost in a joking manner, it's like, you're throwing this in with shchita, trying to answer me back. Shchita is going to be the death of you. Wasn't really talking necessarily, as nevuah, but it's one of those eerie statements where you would understand why something like this would be recorded in hindsight. It's one of those like weird, eerie type of things. No one should read this Gemara and think, oh, it was because Rabbi Akiva had a certain halachic argument, he was destined to have a very violent end. But the fact that he did makes this, it's one of those, one of these things in hindsight where you're like, wow, that was like really an impressive prediction or, eerie choice of words that you used because it actually came to fruition. Okay, well, I thought it was interesting. You don't have to.
I wonder if...
No, all right, I'll do the next one. It's a little bit long. So this is really one of the big stories that we have on Rabbi Akiva and his death. It's Gemara Brachot, Samach Aleph Amud Bet, 61b in Brachot. So our rabbis taught, once the wicked government issued a decree forbidding the Jews to study and practice the Torah, Papas ben Judah came and found Rabbi Akiva publicly bringing gatherings together and occupying himself with the Torah. He said to him, Akiva, are you not afraid of the government? He replied, I will explain to you with a parable. A fox was once walking alongside a river, and he saw fishes going in swarms from one place to another. He said to them, from what are you fleeing? They replied, from the nets cast for us by men. He said to them, "Would you like to come on the dry land so you and I can live together in the way that my ancestors lived with your ancestors?" They replied, "Art thou the one they call the cleverest of animals? Thou art not clever but foolish. If I were afraid in the element in which we live, how much more in the element in which we would die?" Just as a slight digression here, you're reading this midrash sort of for me evokes memories of the Walrus and the Carpenter. If anyone knows that poem, Alice in Wonderland. Time has come, the walrus had to speak of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings and why the sea is boiling hot and whether pigs have wings. No one?
Yeah, no, I've heard this poem.
Okay, yeah. Look it up online. Not going to go through the whole thing here. The fact that I know what I do by heart is scary enough.
Walrus and Carpenter.
The Walrus and the Carpenter.
So since you digressed...
Lewis Carroll.
What is
Shemichta? Shechita, you mean, from the previous source. Slaughter.
Oh.
So in the context, it meant Rabbi Akiva was, gave an argument regarding the ritual slaughter of animals to make it kosher, and Rabbi Eliezer says, "Oh, you brought in shechita, an argument from killing, this is going to be the death of you." That was his idiom. So far we've got, in 61b here, Rabbi Akiva's teaching Torah publicly in defiance of the government, and they said, "Aren't you afraid?" And he said, "Well, just like this case of the fox, saying, well, the fox was trying to get the kids to, not the kids, the fox was trying to get the fish to just jump out of the water so it would be easier for him to eat." And they said, "Ha, if we're scared enough of the nets where we are, certainly we're going to be more scared when it's not in our element. So too it is with us. If such is our condition when we sit and study the Torah, of which it is written, for thy life, for that is thy life and thy length of days, if we go and neglect it, how much worse off would we be?" So, an interesting theological point here. It's like you can say, well, why are you an observant Jew when things are so bad for you because you're observant? And he says, that's exactly the point. If things are this bad for us when we're doing what we're supposed to, think of how much worse they would be for us if we didn't. It is related soon afterwards, Rabbi Akiva was arrested and thrown into prison. And Papas Bar Judah was also arrested in prison next to him. He said to him, "Papas, who brought you here?" He replied, "Happy are you, Akiva, for that you have been seized for busying yourself with Torah. Alas for Papas, who is seized for busying himself with idle things." When Rabbi, so here we kind of have the a support for Rabbi Akiva, where when there's oppression against the Jews, it's not going to matter whether or not you're learning Torah or not learning Torah. You can still wind up in the exact same place. And this guy Papas Bar Judah said, "You know what? At least you got in for a good reason. You were defending Torah. I wasn't even doing Jewish stuff." So when Rabbi Akiva was taken out for execution, it was the hour for the recital of the Shema. And when they combed his flesh with iron combs, he was accepting upon himself the kingship of heaven. His disciples said to him, "Our teacher, even to this point," he said to them, "all my days I've been troubled by the verse, with all thy soul, b'chol nafshecha," which I interpret, "even if he takes your soul." I said, "When shall I have the opportunity of fulfilling this? Now that I have the opportunity, shall I not fulfill it?" He prolonged the word echad until he expired while saying it. A bat kol, a heavenly echo, went forth and proclaimed, "Happy art thou, Akiva, that thy soul has departed with the word echad." The ministering angel said before the Holy One, "Blessed be he, such is Torah and such a reward. He should have been from them that die by thy hand, O Lord." He replied to them, their portion is in life." Batkel came forth and proclaimed, "Happy art thou, Rabbi Akiva, thou art destined for the life in the world to come." So this is where you have the poetry of El Ezkara, that really builds off of this. Right. And really just, I apologize for reading it a little bit devoid of emotion here. But you can definitely see how this would be such a very emotional moment of one of the great leaders who is held in such high esteem, being tortured to death, and the one thing he's thinking about is saying Shema, and not only saying Shema, but looking on this whole incident fondly in a weird way, because it means he can actually fulfill reciting Shema in the way that he always taught and didn't think he'd be able to do. And it's because of
the ultimate test.
Exactly. And instead of shirking from it, he's like, "Wow, I'm embracing this. I can actually do it." So that despite what we could probably consider as indescribable pain, he's primarily thinking about doing mitzvah. And it's largely because of the source that people are ma'arich the dalet, that they lengthen the dalet when they, you know, say Shema. Why people say Shema Yisrael as their last dying breath. Right? There's no necessary halacha that this is what you have to, but with a story like this, you know, it's kind of hard not to, of like, to really, you know, worship God, b'chol nafshecha, to really try and think about what that means. I'll do the last one too. We did this. Stephen, go ahead. This is to fill this in a bit. This is a Gemara Menachot that we saw a few weeks ago, but I wanted to bring this past this last line in because it speaks to it. It involves a discussion about Moshe Rabbeinu having a discussion with God first on not knowing what the crowns of the Torah were. And Moshe was a little upset by that, and he said, well, you know, what do they mean? God takes him, you know, shows him Rabbi Akiva, who said this is halacha Moshe Misinai, that it's you know, it's a tradition that we have for Moshe at Har Sinai, which made Moshe feel a little bit better. But he asked, well, if Rabbi Akiva is so great that he can expound on this, why did not give the Torah to him? And he said, you know, this is my decree. So take it, Stephen. This is Menachot 29b.
Then said Moses, Lord of the universe, thou hast shown me this Torah. Show me his, Rabbi Akiva's, reward. Turn thee round, said he. And Moshe turned round and saw them weighing out his flesh at the market stalls.
Meaning he was like actually dismembered in some way. Yeah.
Lord of the universe, cried Moses, such Torah and such a reward. He replied, be silent, for such is my decree.
So we have the same question, a zotara v'zoschara, right? Not zu, it's zo. You know, this is the Torah and this is its reward. The same question that we had in Brachot. The answer in Brachot was, you know, that it's, you know, chalkam b'chay, you know, their portion is for the life, and that you actually did get an answer. And the Gemara in Menachot, you don't have an answer. It's simply, this is what it is for no other reason than I say so. The first, you know, source that we saw in Brachot seems, I think, a little bit more satisfactory than the second one, my opinion at least, because you have some sort of answer to it, which is like, yeah, the reward isn't now, the reward is in the world to come. The Gemara Menachot, it's, you know, kind of like a shut up and deal with it type of arrangement.
Uh-huh.
But yes, this is, you know, in the discussions of the death of Rabbi Akiva, even up to the last days of his in prison, he's considered to, you know, have not only been a leader, that people would go out and seek his Torah at great personal expense and at great risk, both to themselves and also to Rabbi Akiva, but it's, you know, one of the things that I think has certainly helped, for lack of a better term, the legend of Rabbi Akiva. And I, you know, don't want to use the term legend in terms of, you know, just the pure fictional sense, but at least the tradition of how we view Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Akiva's greatness, and why we might consider him to be, or why he's probably one of the most well-known of the ten martyrs. Not just because we have a graphic description of his death, but, you know, we spent 3 weeks on him. There's a lot of Torah that he taught, and even up until the end, you see the trials and tribulations that he went through just to continue his role as a teacher.
Right.
So, things to, you know, keep in mind when thinking about Rabbi Akiva, and also with Elaz Kura too. Because if you just think, oh yeah, you know, they're just a whole bunch of great rabbis that got killed, you know, you also have to put it in a little bit of context of what exactly, you know, who were these rabbis in context? What did they do? What did they know? And what did losing these rabbis mean to the people around them? Meaning, if you have a rabbi that's so great that you have a question, you go to him in prison. You could say, well, he's in prison, give him a break. Like, imagine if, you know, I don't know, hypothetically, you get thrown in jail and your boss comes in and asks you to do work from your cell. Probably when it's like, you know what, I'm already in jail. I really don't need to deal with this. You know, Rabbi Akiva, you not only didn't shirk from it, you know, I mean, teaching might have been a little bit different, but would, you know, answer questions. He was, you know, still involved with it and didn't let it go. That's when you're on that level and people are still relying on you, to lose someone like that in that role, it would certainly be disheartening. And especially when you have an end that's as a, you know, as, whatchamacallit, as poignant as his. you may also point out that we saw a couple of weeks ago, we had a line that tzedakah tatzil mimavet, tzedakah saves you from death, not only from a gruesome death, but also from a, you know, from death in general, because of an incident that happened with his daughter, where she meant to give tzedakah and saved his life, and saved her own life. And yet, despite that, you know, having a statement of tzedakah tatzil mimavet, one would assume that Rabbi Akiva was charitable. And yet, despite it going against an earlier teaching of his, you don't find people saying, wait a second, this didn't quite work out well for you. I mean, just because you give charity doesn't make you immortal. So another interesting point to consider within the thought of Rabbi Akiva and within his death.
I think if Moshe Feinstein was in prison, people would have come to ask him questions too.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. Depends what he'd be in prison for. Like, sometimes he'd be discredited. If it was clearly like the government is out to get us, you know, probably. I wouldn't know. I would guess he would have some medieval sources that discuss that. I know there was one medieval case. You'll forgive me for blanking on the rabbi's name. I'm sure someone's going to call me up and correct me about it. But, when a rabbi was imprisoned and held for ransom, he actually told the Jewish community, don't ransom me. You know, was actually able to issue some edicts like that because he said once the government realizes, well, you know, if we kidnap rabbis and we imprison them, we're just going to get ransomed, then that just means you're going to, you know, they're just going to keep on doing it, just to extort money. So, yeah, I would guess that there probably are stories from the Middle Ages, too, about, you know, visiting certain rabbis. We don't have as many of them that we do on Rabbi Akiva, at least in the Gemara, or at least in the Gemara that I know of. Things to consider about the death of Rabbi Akiva. Next week we should have another Beit Midrash session. Don't have a topic on the yet, thinking about it. If anyone has any requests, please feel free to submit them. And then the week after we'll get back to Who's Who in the Talmud. Also not sure what we're doing, maybe Rav Meir, maybe Rav Tarfon, but we're still going to be in the Tana Itik area and there's still plenty to do. So thank you for coming out, and hope to see you. Oh, yes. All right. Well, I'll stop the recording here. Thank you all very much for listening.